Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Monday, and it is impossible to catch up with all of the things that have been going on. I do have a piece in the Bulwark today that I wanted to highlight, how Donald Trump turned the pandemic into identity politics. It's with some thoughts about the protests over the weekend, including several in my home state of Wisconsin. We don't know yet whether these protests will be vectors of disease, but I think it's already established that they are vectors of stupidity. Look, I'm trying to make the point before you start screaming at me that there are legitimate issues that are being raised here. I mean, there's something fundamentally American about pushing back against government overreach and protesting. And some of the legal arguments against things that the governors have done, including here in Wisconsin, the arguments are not trivial. But there were alternatives to the sort of in-your-face performative defiance that happened over the weekend. And it's easy to dismiss these as AstroTurf fringe things. I know a lot of focus on Alex Jones's involvement, and Washington Post has an excellent story about the far-right gun activists who have been setting up the Facebook pages. But I do think it's also important to understand the Trump world is all into this sort of populist libertarian zombie Tea Party revolt. And you're seeing conservative organizations, conservative media, completely committed to all of this, including here in Wisconsin. And I do think that so it's, again, it's sort of easy to brush off. I'm not saying that it is representative of public opinion. The vast majority of Americans seem to be more concerned about prematurely reopening. There were some polls over the weekend. But I do think that this moment that I think some of us have been most concerned about, where you get, you know, red versus blue, where the culture war has this overlay on our response to the pandemic. The consequences of this, that's not new, of course, that we have this kind of identity us versus them politics, but for it to play out in the context of a pandemic at this moment is extraordinarily dangerous. So we're going to take a little bit of a step back from the news of the day, because there is a new book out that I've been very anxious to talk about and spent a good portion of the weekend reading with a little bit of trepidation, because the title is Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites by Robert Saldine and Stephen Tellis. It is published by Oxford University Press. And Robert Saldine, who is a professor at the University of Montana, joins us on the podcast. How are you?
Hi, Charlie. I'm good. Regular listener dating back to the Weekly Standard podcast. So to be with you.
Oh, really? Oh, excellent. Thank you so much. Okay, so I wanted to talk about the title, because the first thing that when I first saw this, and you were kind enough to speak to me about the book, was the use of the word elites, because I thought, oh no, never Trumpers, you know, that's been thrown at us so long. And so I want to come back to that in a moment, because I think your discussion, I think, is very valuable. And I just want to say that this is really an excellent book. And I say this as somebody who has lived through the rise, fall, and the irrelevance of the Never Trump movement, or wherever we're at right here, right now. And I think you talk to the right people, and your analysis, I think, is really cogent and really valuable. And I found it valuable, so I would strongly recommend it to the listeners. But let me read you something that you wrote to sort of, you know, put all this in perspective. One story that could be spun about the Never Trump movement, already prominent in many circles, is that it was a rather pitiful last gasp of a decadent, exhausted, and now vanquished elite. Okay, now this is where I started thinking about the day drinking. Okay. The Republican Party had once thought that it was essential to build up its own counter-establishment of right-leaning professionals to oppose the forces of liberalism in such disparate areas as national security, law, and economics, and based in think tanks, magazines, and universities. Conservatives created a parallel network of experts and intellectuals, what we call the Republican Extended Party Network, who were in conflict with their counterparts on the left, while also operating inside their world. The rise of Donald Trump, however, repulsed the party's class of experts. Not only did he reject many of their key ideas and spurned many of their claims to jurisdiction and governance. He also expressed disinterest or even scorn for the history of conservative thought they held dear, and his approach to governance lacked any role for the expertise they had grown accustomed to providing. Trump demonstrated in his rhetoric and actions all of the calumnies thrown against conservatives that never-Trumpers had devoted their careers to refuting. And then a little bit later, you're talking about what's going to happen in the future. There are scenarios in which the forces of Never Trump once burned brightly, but have now gone all but dark. That's certainly one possibility, is not the only one, nor the most likely. We'll come back to that. So that frames, I think, the overview of your argument here. So tell me about this. Who are the Never Trumpers and why do you call them elites?
Yeah. So, I think, Charlie, basically, how we view Never Trump is as an elite phenomenon. And by that, we mean that the Never Trumpers are not just people down the street, normal citizens. These are party actors. And that's really what this was an elite phenomenon within the Republican Party. And this gets into a little bit. I won't go too far into the political science wonkiness of this, but basically, political parties have been understood by political scientists in a couple of different ways. Probably the most prominent way is as groups of ambitious office seekers, and these office seekers, they construct all kinds of mechanisms that serve their interests. Right. Another prominent way of understanding parties is as coalitions of interest groups or activists. But Steve and I think that those kinds of accounts miss a lot of activity that we can reasonably think of as partisan. And in particular, it leaves out a lot of the people who provide a whole range of really critical professional services to parties. And one way of thinking about this is that just these days there are a lot of tasks that parties have to take care of. So we're talking here about things like running a modern campaign, right? This just requires the services of a set of professionals. You need pollsters and communications people, consultants, and the like. You've also got to staff the bureaucracy if your party wins the presidency. So you've got to fill, some 4,000 jobs for political appointees. And you need experts to do this, especially foreign policy experts, economists, lawyers. And then we also talk about this whole realm of generating ideas. And so parties have these structures in place for developing ideas, developing a coherent ideology, policies that go along with them, and then they enforce these borders that they put up. So you have people in places like magazines and think tanks and universities who play these gatekeeping roles and determine, what ideological concepts and policies become associated with their party. And so basically, when we talk about it as an elite phenomenon, we're talking about these service providers who play these roles within political parties.
Yeah, and then to your focus, I mean, look, there are Never Trumpers, obviously, who are the average person down the street. These are the people who have been shifting away from the Republican Party in recent years, average voters. But this is the focus on the people that used to be the gatekeepers. So let's talk a little bit about the culture gap between the party grassroots activists, the kinds of people that have embraced Donald Trump, and this group of Never Trumpers, including the intellectuals, the thought leaders, and this is what I thought was really interesting: the different worlds they operate in, the importance that they ascribe to ideas, and to try to make conservatism more rational and more palatable. And this has been a very, very different approach from the Breitbart kind of wing of the right wing, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is, Charlie. And so, one of the little metaphors we use in the book is the idea that there's a monster down in the basement. And so, a lot of the Never Trumpers we spoke to, in fact, nearly all, I would say, it's not like, and you would know this perhaps as well as anyone else. It's not like people were unaware that there were these strains of populism and nationalism and xenophobia out there within the conservative universe, right? That's not something that people didn't recognize was a part of the history of the conservative movement and everything else. But there was a story that conservatives told themselves, and this is especially prominent at someplace like National Review, mm-hmm. A big part of what the conservative movement was a purging of people who were unacceptable, and there was a way of putting up barriers between deeming some areas as legitimately conservative and other areas illegitimately conservative.
The John Birch Society, the racist, the anti-Semites.
Derbyshire, yeah, all of that. And so and a lot of conservatives and a lot of Never Trumpers kind of thought that those battles had been fought and they'd been won. And yet, you know, yes, maybe there are elements of them still out there on the fringes, but they've been marginalized to an extent that we don't have to worry about them too much anymore. And again, to get back to this analogy of the monster in the basement, you know, we recognize there's this monster in the basement, and you know, maybe every once in a while, if we really need to, right before an election, we can let the monster out and to kind of whip up our base. But the key point is that we're the ones who control the monster. We've got the key, and we've got it contained. And so it was quite a surprise then, I think, for a lot of people who turned towards Never Trump to recognize that this monster got out. In fact, it turns out we didn't have control of it, and it cut against their whole understanding of themselves and the conservative movement as something that was respectable. And here it was being co-opted and taken over by someone they saw as a demagogue and just embodying right. all of those things that they thought had been purged from the movement.
Well, the point you also make is the fact that this group of Never Trumpers really had believed that the conservative movement was intellectually respectable and coherent, that they had made progress by purging the crazies and the crackpots, you know, had created certain guardrails, were able to define conservatism in terms of these values and these norms. Whereas what felt like was happening in 2016 was the wholesale rejection of that intellectual tradition. And that rather than trying to make conservatism more coherent, more palatable, more effective, you had this populist movement, which was sort of inwardly focused. So in other words, you know, many of the writers, like I say, George Will, who would have tried to speak to a broad audience, including people on the center left, trying to persuade them, as opposed to that, you now had a new media, a new culture that was focused on the base to convince them of the evils of liberalism, to convince them that they were under siege, that they were victims. So you really had a completely alternative culture arise in the conservative movement. Is that a fair way of describing it?
Well, I think that's exactly right, Charlie. And just the other thing I'd say here is that in the new media environment we have, things have changed. And so, you know, I think back to that National Review issue, which was against Trump. It's actually kind of remembered as the Never Trump issue, but it actually said against Trump, which is an important distinction for some people. But that was basically an attempt to purge Trump, right? In the way that Buckley purged the Birchers and Derbyshire and everything. But their attempt to play that old gatekeeping role, it didn't work anymore. You know, now National Review, it's not the only game in town in this expanded media universe. And, you know, Rich Lowry had a kind of nice way of putting something that I think is important. He said, I'm paraphrasing here, but basically he was comparing National Review to Breitbart. And he says, look, Breitbart runs a website for their comment section. Right. That's the kind of sensibility they're going for. National Review runs a website that wants to correct the comment section and explain to our readers where, where they're wrong. And I guess that works fine if you only read National Review, but that's not the only thing out there anymore. Right. And there's more than just National Review and the George Will column. People have all these other places to go. And so that old gatekeeping role that the elite level conservative intellectuals used to play, it's just a hell of a lot harder now.
OK, so you do spend a lot of time focusing on National Review and on Rich Lowry, somebody that I've admired for many years and was really heartened when that edition came out. Although I will tell you, in real time, it felt late in the day. It felt, you know, I had been on radio pounding away at Donald Trump since June. And this did not come out until 2016, when it was almost too late. But the story of National Review, and in some ways you do frame the trajectory of Never Trump by looking at National Review, the role that it played back in the 1960s when William F. Buckley Jr. really did draw these lines. John Birch Society out later in the 1990s, pushing back against the anti-Semitism of Pat Buchanan, firing people like John Derbyshire, firing Ann Coulter, getting rid of Joseph Sobran, because these were not the people who were legitimate voices for conservatism. And I think part of the shock of 2016 was that, you know, many of the sorts of people who had been cast into darkness had been purged from the conservative movement, now suddenly were making their way back into the mainstream and into the center of power. But let's talk about this, because you said there was a distinction between that headline that said "Against Trump and Never Trump," and I think you do a really good job of kind of explaining that National Review kind of hedged in 2016, didn't they?
Absolutely, and you know, Charlie, I mean, never Trump is a controversial term, and of course it started out as a hashtag, so it's not like initially this was some well thought out thing. People kind of
who invented the hashtag, now that you mention that?
Yeah, you know, we kind of got into that a little bit in the book, and it's not entirely clear. The people who popularized it, though, were this kind of group of political operatives around Mindy Finn. Mindy Finn was a former RNC-er, and she went on to run as the vice presidential candidate on the third party Evan McMullen headed kind of never Trump ticket. But their group, and again, they started late in the day too. And this is a total theme that runs through all of 2016. All of this activity, it all started too late.
Was late. Okay, so I'm sorry. I was just trying to remember where I saw it when I first saw it, and I actually think I saw it on a website run by Eric Erickson, which of course is highly ironic because he's now supporting Trump. So let's go back. The hedge of National Review, they went very strong with the Against Trump edition, but it was not Never Trump, and they never went Never Trump. So what's the difference between Against Trump and Never Trump?
Well, as they see it, it was not that they were pledging to be Never Trump in the way that, say, I think you understood that term, right, Charlie. But they said, look, as long as we've got other reasonable alternatives out there, we are against Trump. It doesn't mean that we're pledging to be against him forever. And when we get to the general election, that's a different matter, and we'll see what the option is. And if he wins the presidency, you know, we'll take it issue by issue and like that. So as much as that National Review issue is kind of remembered as a Never Trump thing, for the editors of National Review, that is not what they meant. And that word "against" was chosen very carefully.
And yet you point out that Rich Lowry wrote a column separate from National Review that really was extremely anti-Trump, and it was a little bit controversial because he went further than the magazine he edited went.
Yeah, and you know, I think I would also say, you know, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you thought the issue kind of came out too late. Well, they didn't think so at the time. It came out right before one of the primaries. I think it might have been Wisconsin. One that Trump lost, and after that primary, Rich Lowry actually sent out a tweet that said, "You're welcome."
Right? Well, I think it was after Iowa that he said
after Iowa.
Yeah, Yeah. Which is highly premature.
It was Iowa, and so they thought they had taken him out. Right. And the way, you know, things have worked in the past, you know, maybe there was reason to think that. But Iowa, the first one out of the gate, went a different direction. But of course, he went on to Cruz from there. But they kind of thought that they had taken him out. And obviously that didn't happen.
OK, so this is where I'm going with this, because I'm looking at your discussion of that piece in National Review, which again is one of the kind of the milestones of what's been going on in the conservative movement. And that was the entire issue was devoted to being against Trump. And it had a lead editorial, and then it had a symposium with 22 different articles penned by a wide range of conservative luminaries. And then you list them, and I'm looking at the list. OK, so Mona Charon, who's still never Trump. Ben Dominic, who has runs the Federalist, which has become very anti-Trump. It's pretty Trumpist. Bill Kristol, who of course is our colleague, Yuval Levin, who I think is continues to be a principled conservative. But then you have folks like R.R. Reno, who runs First Things. You also have Glenn Beck, who's now gone full Trump now. Eric Erickson, who's voting for Trump. You have and again going through some of these people. Including Brent Brozell, founder of Media Research Center, who is completely Trumpist at this point. So I get, and you go through the book and you talk about the functionaries, the people who make their living through campaigns. And right. I certainly understand why most of them would go where the power and the money is. There are certain exceptions like Rick Wilson and Mike Murphy and others that you talk about, and our own Tim Miller. I actually even understand the politicians who feel that that they've lost the base and there's too much risk to breaking with Trump. But let's talk about because about half your book though is on these thought leaders, these intellectuals, these people in the media. Why did so many of them who articulated so strongly their objections to Trump, why have they become pro-Trump now? What happened there?
So this kind of gets at an important point we make in the book, is that I think the way of understanding Never Trump has to include a recognition of the professional milieus that these people come out of. And so that's the way we organize the book, right? We have a couple chapters on the foreign policy experts. We have a couple chapters on the political operatives. We have a couple chapters on the media and public intellectuals and writers, and then a chapter on lawyers and economists. And so one of the key things is that never Trump was not any one thing. It was a series of things that flowed through these professional group identities. And so they each have their own story, right? And you mentioned, some of these people, the political operatives who, as a class started out pretty much all against Trump. But by the end, there were very few of them. And which ones there were, shared some things in common. For instance, they'd already made a lot of money. They didn't depend as much on their consulting gigs anymore. They didn't need that. They had the flexibility that some people don't. Whereas a lot of these people in the media world, had a little bit more flexibility because, they had jobs at newspapers and magazines, and same with the foreign policy experts, right? A lot of them, are at universities and think tanks when they aren't, in government. And so all of these little milieus have their own little story. Now, when it comes to some of the media people, I mean, you mentioned Eric Erickson for one, and you would know this, Charlie, better than I. But there certainly is a difference within that world between people like George Will, who really can do whatever he wants for a variety of reasons now, and someone like Eric Erickson, who basically is a radio guy.
No, in fact, you were kind enough to quote me on all of this, basically that I'm kind of the freak here because I'm one of the few never Trumpers to come out of the electronic media, although that's right. Only part of, and I do say that, I mean, basically it comes down to it. There's no business model to be in conservative media and to be critical of Trump anymore. That if that is your business model, you really have no choice. You know, whereas many of the people that you're describing, at least, are not dependent on conservative donors, the conservative infrastructure, the conservative base to provide them with an audience, with income and everything. And that's certainly one of the great bright lines that we're seeing.
Yeah. They are conservatives, but they're conservatives within liberal institutions, right? And the conservatives, like the radio people, there was always a little bit of attention about who's really calling the shots, who's in the lead. Is it the radio personality, or does the radio personality kind of have to follow his or her audience, right? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
In a way, and that's kind of a different job than if you're on the op-ed page at the Washington Post or the New York Times, right? You're kind of one who's trying to explain respectable conservatism to a group of non-conservatives for the most part.
Well, this is what I found interesting because I kind of have been in both worlds. You know, I was on the radio, but I was also in the think tank world. So I was, on the air 3.5 hours a day, but I'd also written books, was affiliated with, the Bradley Foundation and various others, and really did think of the conservative movement, in the way that you describe other people who did not go along with Donald Trump. I really was, thinking that it was a coalescing of these ideas. And I saw the radio show as a way of expressing those ideas. And I'm not sure that was a universal point of view. So I do understand that in that way, very, very few talk show hosts were able to stay on the air and be in opposition to Donald Trump. And I think I told you, when Trump was running for president, every single conservative radio talk show host in Wisconsin was anti-Trump, and he lost here badly. I'm gone, but everybody else who is still on the air, even the most outspokenly other anti-Trumpers, are now all in on Trump. And I frankly don't think that they have a business model. So here's the question that I wanted to get to. And this was helpful to me in your book. There is a line of thinking, particularly on the left, that all conservatives are alike. On Twitter, virtually every other day, no, every single day, somebody will say, when I post an article, say, well, yeah, Charlie, but you gave us Trump. You conservatives built this because Donald Trump is the expression of the conservative movement. He's the inevitable organic creation of conservatives. And therefore, his ascendancy is retrospectively an indictment of all of the things that conservatives said they believed in, said that they were about, and that, in fact, conservatism was always sort of proto-Trumpism. And I think what was valuable in your book was that, wait, there are these different strains and they are very, very much in tension. So did the conservative, quote unquote, elites, the people who we think of as the never Trumpers, are they responsible for Donald Trump? At least, is there some truth to it?
Yeah, well, I think there's some truth to it. I think a lot of the people who went never Trump, did fail to recognize that that they lived in a bubble and that in their world, and it's largely a kind of DC, New York based thing with some outposts in university towns and things like this. It's very easy to kind of isolate yourself within that and think that what's really going on in the conservative universe, it takes place between George Will's column and Ross Douthat's column and this whole kind of very intellectual world.
Charles Krauthammer, who's no longer with us.
Krauthammer, right. And that is, I think, a part of the conservative world, an important part, but I think some some never Trumpers thought that that was what conservatism was. That was what Republican Party politics was. And to the extent that some people thought that was the case, I think they missed a lot that was going on out there.
Well, okay, so you're right, but I mean, I was in touch with a conservative grassroots here in Wisconsin. I was in touch with those people that were involved in the Tea Party, and I was always conscious that there was kind of that dark underbelly out there. But I always figured that those people could be, you could appeal to the better angels of their nature. You could focus them in more constructive areas. Some of them were the crackpots at the end of the bar, but they were always going to be isolated. But it is true that I think that we made alliances, for short-term advantage. We looked the other way. We tolerated things that we shouldn't tolerate. And I think that there may have been some buttons that were pressed that we did not fully understand all of the implications. That we may have meant one thing that when we said it, but it was heard in a very, very different way.
Yeah, Charlie, we heard versions of this from so many people. One that stands out to me is Eric Edelman, who's one of the kind of deans of the national security experts in D.C. And he told us about something that his old boss, George W. Bush, used to say is that, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it's something along the lines, you don't have to scratch far beneath the surface before you run into these really nasty strains of xenophobia and populism and whatnot. And part of our job, Bush said, according to Edelman, is to push back on that, to keep that in check. And in fact, that dovetails very nicely, Charlie, with this kind of old idea about what a political party should do in a liberal democracy, right? This idea that parties are critical mediating institutions that you have to maintain the health of liberal democracy, right? They play a filtering role that pushes back against some of the pathologies that you would otherwise find in the pure democracy, right? Things like demagoguery. And so one way of understanding, I think, the 2016 election is that basically what we witnessed was a collapse of one of these mediating institutions, the Republican Party. The Republicans failed in their effort to filter out a candidate who represented in many ways a rejection of their principles and who embodied all the traits of a classic demagogue. Right, the very thing in a way in which the American political party system was designed to keep out, and that we rely on political parties to do, and so I think it's all your points are reasonable and fair, and I'd also say we could identify things on the left that Democrats have to grapple with and take on, and so this just goes with party politics in general. I do think you could say some Republicans failed to see quite how potent some of those forces were on their own side. But this is just something inherent in the nature of living in democracy.
Yeah, no, I mean, when I wrote my book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, I was wrestling with all of this, The title is not just that the right went crazy, but it also was the rejection of this intellectual tradition. It was profoundly shocking to me, to see someone like Donald Trump, who would call, I can't remember the exact terminology, George Will a dummy, Charles Krauthammer a dummy. These were the people who had defined what conservatism was. So part of that was the shock, but also the shock that we weren't who we thought we were. And I was really wrestling with that. How did we contribute to this? How could the allies that we had thought we were leading in some ways, how did they turn out to be so different or have such different values? I had a really hard time in 2016 and 2017 understanding what was going on with evangelical Christians. And so this is the question that I've been asking myself. What did we ignore? What did we not understand about all of this? And can you put that genie back in the bottle? Because I'm thinking in terms of like race, for example. In 2016, if you would have asked me, you know, what is the future of the conservative movement, I would say, look at what Paul Ryan is talking about. Remember what Jack Kemp said. You know, these are the kinds of things we're going to put that past behind us. But look at kind of the things that now I think that we have to confront about, you know, the compromises that conservatives made, some of the wink wink that went on there. And I think that there's still a reckoning there. And I think that that's part of the problem that many of the Never Trumpers are not willing to simply say, okay, on a transactional basis, we're willing to make compromises that we never would have conceived of a few years ago.
Right. And I mean, I think, you know, kind of looking forward, this is something that a lot of Never Trumpers are having to grapple with now. And, you know, for a while, Charlie, I think there was a sense that, maybe this thing will self-destruct. And, you know, through the 2016 campaign and even in the early years of the administration, you know, this thing is going to implode and maybe there'll be an opportunity just if we keep the candle burning to put it back together the way it used to be. And, you know, now for so many reasons, that just seems, it just seems pretty unlikely. That's going to happen, even if Donald Trump loses this fall.
Let's talk about this, because you have an interesting final chapter to this book. And by the way, your discussion of how about the efforts to stop Donald Trump in the primaries at the convention, the efforts to recruit a third party candidate, including the attempt to get James Mattis to run as an independent, the push to have David French be the independent candidate. You know, some people may remember, or maybe have half forgotten some of that, but that's all fascinating stuff. But let's talk about what happens next, because it's certainly possible that Never Trumpers will remain irrelevant, that they've just been cast out of the Republican Party, and that whatever happens, they will play no part. But you think that there's a possibility that in fact, that there is a future for folks like me.
Yeah. So this is kind of how we ended up the book. I mean, you know, a lot of people say, as you well know, Charlie, look, these Never Trumpers are totally irrelevant. Their time has passed, and a lot of people would say, and good riddance. But we do think there's another path, and in laying this out, we kind of extrapolate down from what we consider kind of this elite level phenomenon, the Never Trump thing, but how it kind of funnels down into society. But the basic idea is that we think there's a demand out there for more than just a couple things, and polarization in this plays an important role in this story. You know, I was talking to your colleague Jim Swift mm-hmm. A few days ago, and he was explaining to me how you used to work on Capitol Hill and worked for a long time in the Republican Party, and now there's no place for me. And this is it's not natural, basically. We think that there's only kind of two options in a large, diverse country like the United States. And, in a lot of countries, the way you deal with this problem is you have a whole bunch of parties, right? So you have a center left party, a center right party, a far left, far right, and a bunch of things in between. That's not what we have in the United States. We have a two party system, and there are all kinds of institutional reasons why it's very, very hard to start a third party. And so all of this action has to go on within the two major parties. Now, the interesting thing about the recent few decades is that the parties are pretty darn homogenous. But that's not the way this stuff has played out over the course of United States history. Basically, our parties traditionally have had these competing factions within them. And so, within the Republican Party, there was a progressive faction back in the day, and a stalwart faction. And you kind of had this Nelson Rockefeller faction of moderates or even liberals based in the Northeast, and a conservative faction, of course. Democrats have their own story, right, with the Southern Democrats and liberal Northerners and what. But the point is that these were organized groups, and they had, on the one hand, a kind of shared interest in defeating the other party, right? You got to win the White House and get everything that flows from that. But they were also in competition with one another inside the party. And so they had to negotiate with one another for how to, you know, for instance, organize the party caucus in Congress. And so we do think that there is a possibility, right? One scenario, and in fact, we're careful to couch it as a scenario. This isn't some, you know, social science thing that's predetermined, right? But it's a scenario. And especially if Trump loses this fall, that there's a possibility for this kind of a return to what has been the norm for American history of factional political parties.
So you're saying that there's going to be, and the faction that you envision, you call the liberal conservative faction, small L, small C faction, in recognition of their grounding in classical liberal principles of free markets, pluralism, and constitutionalism. And this would be a faction in opposition to what? The ongoing populist, nationalist, Trumpian wing of the party, which is not going to go away even if Donald Trump goes away. Correct?
No, it's not going to go away. And I think there's every reason to think it'll be the dominant faction too. But there are the Jim Swifts and the Charlie Sykeses of the world who feel like, you know, that's not a good fit. But also, and I'm not sure where you are on this, Charlie, but Jim was telling me the other day, you know, I'm not going to become a Democrat, right? Yeah. And all kinds of reasons, that's just not a good fit. And I think if you extrapolate down beyond the kind of small group of never Trumpers that we discuss in the book, you know, think about just the you know, at the societal level, the educated middle class, you know, business, upwardly mobile segments of ethnic minority groups, right? There are these groups out there in society that aren't a great fit to either just go all in with the Democrats or with Trumpy Republicans. And you can think about it in terms of some issues too, like free trade and constitutionalism and you know, pro market stuff, right? There are stark differences here. And you know, Steve and I at least think this is not the craziest thing to imagine, that you could have a kind of more organized interest, because we already see something like this at work in Massachusetts with Charlie Baker, and in Maryland with Larry Hogan, right? These are Republican governors who are very popular and popular before this whole virus came on the scene, right? They were genuinely popular, and they basically were able to carve out a little space to run as Republicans, but who had a little distance from the mainstream national party. And so far, we've only seen that with regard to, you know, a handful of individuals. It hasn't coalesced around an actual organization. But you could imagine something sure. like the Democratic Leadership Council that the Democrats had back in the 80s and the 90s. And it allowed all these Democrats to say, hey, you know, I'm not a Walter Mondale Democrat. I'm not a Michael Dukakis Democrat. I'm a DLC Democrat, and that's a whole different thing. And people knew what that meant, at least kind of in a vague way, and it allowed them to keep some distance from the national party. And so, you know, there's some reason to think, Steve and I think anyway, that something like that is a scenario,
but not as a third party, but as a faction within the Republican Party.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think third party, a lot of people love the idea of third parties, and you know, maybe if we lived in a different country, that would be the way to go, and it would make a lot of sense.
We're not France.
Yeah, right. There there are reasons for that, right? The way our system is set up, we don't have proportional representation. Yeah, it's winner take all, and it's hard for a third party to get up and running, right? We've had the same two parties now for over 150 years. And so, again, if we lived in a multi-party system, that would make all the sense in the world, but we don't. And again, the way we've traditionally dealt with these kinds of, with the need for more than just two options in the United States is to have internal party factions. And that's created that space.
I think this is a very interesting point, because you're describing a very large, important part of the electorate that right now has somewhat orphaned, well, would certainly be orphaned if the Democratic Party eventually moves left. I'm not sure this year, but if they do move in the Bernie slash AOC way and the Republican Party means primarily Trumpist, where do these people go? And again, you describe them in the book, educated middle class, business, more upwardly mobile parts of ethnic minority groups. They would combine cultural liberalism with a pro-market but reformist, less thoroughly anti-government ideology on economic matters. They would be recognizably conservative, especially on issues like social order, opposition to public sector unions, and a general pro-market orientation. And you could really see that sort of a faction. It may not be dominant within the Republican Party, but it could win in certain parts of the country so that it becomes relevant in that sense, but also provides a home for people that are rejecting the extremes.
Well, exactly, Charlie, and it works in tandem with what's going on within the Democratic Party, right? We can already see the outlines of this pretty clearly, I would say, where you kind of have a moderate cohort and then a newly emergent left faction that we've seen most prominently around Bernie Sanders, but the whole Democratic Socialists of America thing and AOC and all that, and to the extent that wing of the party, the left wing, is especially strong in certain areas of the country, right? That's going to make this group that could form in the Republican Party, this liberal conservative faction, whatever you want to call it. Those are the kind of places in the country where that kind of Republican could be pretty appealing. And incidentally, the very same areas of the country where the Trumpy populist type of Republican is just an absolute non-starter.
Right. Right? So, and there is some overlap then between center right and center left. You don't have the kind of red blue factionalism when you have kind of a more pragmatic centrist sort of approach to these kinds of issues. So let me ask you one last question, because we're running out of time here. What is your sense among Never Trumpers? There are some people who have been conservatives who have been so disillusioned by Donald Trump that they've become, in effect, liberals. You know, you mentioned that Jim Swift doesn't want to become a Democrat. There are obviously some who are now become indistinguishable from Democrats or have made temporary alliances with Democrats. And one of the things that I often hear from, you know, folks who watch MSNBC is that we can't trust these Never Trump conservatives, because you know something? They're still conservatives. So are most Never Trumpers still conservative? The ones you write about?
You know, yeah, look, we've talked to a lot of them and are still in touch with a lot of them. And yes, I think most of them would say, look, I haven't changed all that much. I still hold on to the same principles I had several years ago, but things have changed around me. Now you can point to, maybe Jen Rubin and Max Boot and a handful of others who really have, I think, kind of gone back and reevaluated a whole lot of things and have found themselves in a little bit of a different place. But I think for most of the Never Trumpers out there, there's maybe a little bit of a realization, okay, gosh, we kind of underestimated some things. We ignored some things that maybe we shouldn't have ignored. But their basic principles, they would say, are more or less still the same. Still believe in things like pluralism and liberal democracy and democratic norms and all of these things. To the extent that all these people who I thought were going to be there in the foxhole with me till the end, to the extent right. that they don't, well, you know, that's I guess we've learned about them.
Well, and also, as you point out, there are now some cross-ideological relationships that have been formed sort of during this period under the shock of all of the changes. And you mentioned some of the groups that have actually gone out of their way to put center-right and center-left people together. And I have to say that among the experiences that I had, that, you know, many of which have been pretty horrific, the excommunication and exile from a movement that I thought that I belonged to and devoted much of my professional life to, it has been refreshing to be able to sit down and meet with people from across the aisle and realize that you don't agree on everything, but you have a shared assumption of goodwill, and you kind of wonder where that's going to go, whether that is going to survive, because there are seeds planted and I think this is your point in the book, that something like this will create new dynamics that are very hard to predict where they will end up.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we have seen the flourishing of some of these organizations that have been engaged in what you were just talking about, Charlie. I mean, I guess one thing I wonder about a little is whether Never Trumpers have spent a little bit too much time focusing on some of that stuff and not quite enough time focusing on trying to do the things that the Democratic Leadership Council did back in the day. You know, they had a whole think tank, the Progressive Policy Institute, that went along with that. And, you know, so you could imagine another scenario in which, you know, maybe the Never Trumpers did some of those cross-partisan things, but also really thought hard about building institutions and organizations to harness real political power and make a play for the Republican Party and
they're going to have to. No, you're right.
Building those institutions that make a real faction work.
And that will have to happen, but I think everybody's in survival mode right now. It's like, yeah, let's survive the blitz that we're under right now. But you are right. You do, and I think in the back of your mind, you're thinking of something like the Democratic Leadership Council, which at least for a while had tremendous influence in what happened in the Democratic Party. Right now, it's kind of hard to imagine that happening in a party in which sort of the entire sky is eclipsed by the figure of Donald Trump.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, Charlie, I mean, so much depends on what happens this fall, right? I mean, if Donald Trump wins another term, I mean, that bodes really poorly for the Never Trumpers. And I would also say for at least in the short term, this idea that you could have a faction along the lines that we describe emerge from within the party, because there is just so little space, and even people who I think might be sympathetic to that, they're scared of getting hit with a tweet from the president, the blowback that ensues with all that. But if Trump doesn't win a second term, you could imagine the space being there to create something like we described.
I agree. Thank you so much. I appreciate it very much. The book is Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites, which is available now in ebook, right? You can get it on Amazon.com. I'm reading it on my Kindle. The print copy is going to be coming out later this year. I mean, everything is disrupted, right? Even book publishing has been disrupted by
even book publishing. Yes.
No, I know. I mean, every single author I know has had their pub date messed with by the pandemic. But that's the great thing about electronic books, and you can download the book today. And I have to say, I highly recommend it. It's really an extraordinary work. Robert Saldin, Stephen Tellis, this is Oxford University Press. Robert, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and spending so much time with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Charlie. Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it. Well, thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast today. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.